The date is Thursday, February 3rd, 2011. The first bill tonight will be Senator Ingebrigtsen's Senate File 42. If you could approach witness table, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Before we begin, Senator Ingebrigtsen, I want the record to show that we have a quorum. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm here with Senate File 42. Been through the Environmental Natural Resource Committee with this State Government Ops Committee. This is our next stop with regards to a part of the bill that had to be dealt with your committee, Mr. Chair. And before beginning, if I can, first of all, I'd like to offer the A11 amendment to put the bill in proper shape.
Senator Ingebrigtsen moves the A11 amendment. Could you explain the amendment, Senator Ingebrigtsen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do have a gentleman with me that's going to do just that for you, and I'll have him identify himself, and he can go ahead and do that.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, would you want to describe the bill first before you move the amendment?
Certainly I can do that, Mr. Chair and members. Basically what this is what you may have not heard throughout the halls, I guess, or just recently with regards to the concern of the citizens that we have heard over the past months, probably more like years, with regards to the permitting process and how there has been issues through the DNR and as well as the PCA in getting permits out in a timely fashion. I guess very, very simply, that was the thing that we probably all, each and every one of us, heard when we were out knocking on doors and standing in parades this year is that we just need to get a better response out of our units down here with regards to permitting. Terrible horror stories, some of them true, some of them not quite so true, I might add, in defense of the departments. You hear stories of 5 years, many millions of dollars, and still no permit in hand. Even complaints simply if we're not capable of issuing a permit, we need to know that too in a timely fashion. That wasn't happening. So it was my intent, along with, I should say, in a bipartisan fashion with the governor's office. The governor thought it was important enough to actually put out an executive order. Some of you may or may not have seen that. With regards to the permitting process and hurrying that up, we had a meeting with the new commissioner from the DNR and the PCA, along with leadership from both the House and the Senate. That's probably 2 weeks ago now, and that precipitated, I think, the order coming from the governor. And so that's the immediacy. That is what the hurry was all about. It's not our intent to and some are saying that is the intent, but it's not our intent at all to compromise the environment in any fashion whatsoever. We just want a little better response out of our agencies. And so that's what's brought the bill forward, and we've had good bipartisan support to this point. And I guess I stand for any questions if anyone has any. But that's where it's at.
Thank you, Senator Ingebrigtsen. Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Ingebrigtsen. You know, having been through PCA and DNR permits and the permitting process, and knowing that we can't think of any positive terms about how people permit things, but it's probably not even really within the purview of this committee when we talk about the permitting efficiency, but I would like to know in the general explanation of the bill why we think 5 months is some kind of efficient time frame. You know, these permits aren't rocket science, and they deal with them all the time, and, you know, places like Indiana are able to get them through in 90 days or less. Why are we and we're increasing efficiency at 5 months? Why do we think we need that long for something to sit there and get looked at?
Mr. Chair, if I might.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
I agree with you. That still isn't really quick. Let's you know, if something is simple, let's just get the document to the potential business that wants to come to our state and or expand in our state. But we're just hearing, and again, we had, you know, in defense of the two departments and you've been around longer than I have. You deal with this, and so you probably are battle-tested. However, there is always two sides to every story. However, it just seems to be one-sided, really lopsided here. But who I have with me today is a representative from the chamber that's been dealing with this over the years, and maybe he can give you a little better idea how they feel.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, just before we get too deep into this, there's only a few sections of this bill that are under the jurisdiction of the Judiciary Committee. That would be Article 1, Section 7. I think the bulk of that language is on page 12. And then Article 1, Section 9. So we need to keep focused on that area.
Mr. Chair, if I might, in the general overview of the bill, I think in this time frame, it would speak to, as we understand, why this kind of time frame as the articles that relate to our committee. So I believe that is something that we need to understand the process in order to figure out where we're going with these things in terms of courts and things.
Yeah, Senator Jungbauer, I agree a certain degree of context is necessary.
Yes, but
so
I don't.
We can understand this.
Mr. Chair, I don't require a lengthy explanation, but I would like some background on the timing issue.
We're going to go with our witness first. Could you introduce yourself to the committee?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tony Quillis. I'm the Director of Environmental Policy for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Senator Ingebrigtsen, Senator Jungbauer, to answer your question, this is kind of the second phase, if you will. Last year, we had a number of proposals move forward in the Omnibus Environment and Natural Resources Bill, including e-licensing, customized worksheets, and a 150-day goal for the Department of Agriculture. This year, we would like to move forward with a 150-day goal for the Pollution Control Agency as well as the Department of Natural Resources. The reason for the goal and the subsequent reports that come with it are to drive to a data point to identify why these permits that are over 150 days and why they are, whether it's for confusion over the water quality issue, whether it's confusion over error, whether it's just construction permits or not. So once we accumulate that data, we'll be able to drive to a data point to be able to address that.
Great. Thank you so much. That answers my question.
All right. Any other discussion? You have an amendment, Senator Ingebrigtsen?
Yes, the amendment, and I have Mr. Lightfoot here to address that amendment, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Thad Lightfoot. I am an environmental lawyer in the Twin Cities. I've done a number of environmental review cases over the years, and I appear here on behalf of the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Just briefly, the amendment makes a couple of technical corrections in the bill. It first changes some language to allow the project proposers to prepare preliminary draft environmental impact statements rather than draft environmental impact statements. The rationale for that change is to ensure flexibility in dealing with that information under both the National Environmental Policy Act and our state Minnesota Environmental Policy Act. And then most specifically of interest to this committee, Section 9 of the bill addresses the judicial review provisions under the Minnesota Environmental Policy Act, and the amendment is designed to clarify that a single process for obtaining a writ of certiorari in the Court of Appeals to review environmental review decisions is applicable, and that process is the process under the Minnesota Administrative Procedure Act. There are, unfortunately, two processes for obtaining writs of certiorari in Minnesota, and if the language was silent, it is possible that local governments, when they act as responsible governmental units, might be forced to obtain a writ through one process, and state agencies might be forced to obtain, or there might be a party challenging, might be forced to abuse one process for state agencies and one process for local units of government. And the chamber believed, and Senator Ingebrigtsen believed, that it made the most sense that there be a single clear process so that practitioners such as myself and also the clerk of the Court of Appeals understand exactly what it is that parties need to do to challenge these decisions. That's the basis of the amendment.
Any questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Lapp.
Thank you. On the amendment, the lines 1.3 and 1.4 of the amendment apply to Section 4 of the bill, which the chairman has indicated, is not within the jurisdiction of this committee. What is the chairman's intent with regard to entertaining amendments outside the scope of this committee's jurisdiction?
Senator Latz, did you say Section 4?
That appears to be lines 1.3 and 1.4 of the amendment.
I see a reference to Section 14, but not 4.
On line 1.2 to 1.4 of the amendment. So starting at page 7 after line 13, which is part of Section 4 of the underlying bill. As I'm reading it. I'm not sure that I'm competent determine whether the amendment,
whether
technical or not, is
appropriate. Would you want to make comment on it? It's outside of what you're Senator Ingebrigtsen, do you have any comment about that?
I'm being told by Mr. Chair, I'm being told that these amendments are technical in nature, but that's not the extent of my knowledge here. Is I could certainly defer to Rick Knopf, my analyst, if you would.
Mr. Knopf?
Himself.
Mr. Chairman, members, and Senator Latz, it's my understanding, especially the one that you're referring to on.
Yes, Senator Latz. I had given the floor to
I should introduce myself. I guess I am a staff of the Senate. But Greg Knopf, Senate Council Research and Fiscal Analysis. I'm a Senate analyst with the Environment and Natural Resources Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Knopf, I've spoken on the phone, but I don't think we've ever met.
I don't think we've ever met in person. You're right.
Senator Latz, could you turn the microphone toward you?
Sorry.
Don't want to miss a single word.
Yeah. There you go. Read that into the record again, yeah. Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Knopf, please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, the provision that Senator Latz has been talking about, the application, this is just to clarify, in case there are applications in the works, how that section applies. This is really a technical term to make sure that we know which rulemaking provisions that this is going to apply to, and it basically says that it's made on or after the effective date. So it's really kind of a technical, I think, that either staff or this committee or somebody else caught that, that should have been changed earlier to reflect this.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, well, I'll leave it up to the chair how you wish to handle these kind of matters, but I'm satisfied as to the technical nature of it based on staff's commentary, and I also had the same question relating to another portion of the amendment.
Senator Latz, I've been told by counsel that if we would pass a bill that had a technical issue that's not real substantive, that the previous committee could pull it back for their approval if there was a question about it. So I'm going to proceed with the amendment in this regard, provided that we have an assurance that it's technical. And I think we have been given that. That's the direction of where the author is leading us. Could I have counsel give commentary on it so you hear it as well as I do?
Mr. Chair, members, I was only relaying to you that if it is indeed outside of this committee's jurisdiction and the committee were to adopt it, the other committee would always have the option of bringing it back if it chose to. So if in fact this committee, it was determined that the committee was overstepping its jurisdictional boundaries, there's always that remedy for it. So that's, and especially if it's a technical type thing, that's unlikely to happen.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chairman, we have the counsel for the other committee that had the original jurisdiction on the bill testifying that it's technical. So I will accept that, and maybe we can get the same comment with regard to lines 1.9 to 1.12 of the proposed amendment, which appear to apply to Section 8 of the underlying bill, also not technically within this committee's jurisdiction.
Mr. Knopf?
Mr. Chairman, I guess you'll have to decide what's in your jurisdiction. This is part of the environmental review provision. When you look at lines 1.5 through 1.12. And I think the witness earlier presented that going to a preliminary draft environmental impact statement, or a draft preliminary draft environmental impact statement as opposed to a draft, mentioned that. There is one provision that on 1.9, this is permitted by section 15.99. That has to do with the timelines for environmental review of the action after the environmental impact statement is completed. What this does is there has been some discussion with people representing cities and other local government units that the 30-day conflicts with what they're allowed for zoning permits, and so that's to get that in there. So that's a little more than technical on line 1.9, but it is something that it has been in discussion for a time now, and that was so that. As I understood your earlier discussion, I thought that section was part of the purview of this committee.
Does council have any opinion?
Mr. Chairman, members, yeah, I think everything, the only part that isn't is what's on 1.9 in the amendment, which is in a different section. And as the issue was explained to me, and this is actually amending current law, but right now it says the period can be extended if it's required by federal law or state statute. Under this section, it's permitted but not required. But it's true that section is not within this committee's jurisdiction.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Latz.
Could someone explain to me the significance of that proposed insertion? I mean, who would grant or deny permission, for example? And why is it important to have that there?
Mr. Chairman, if I understand the question, I thought Ms. Pontius explained it pretty well, and I think that because currently under 15.99, the local governments have 60 days to approve zoning, and there are some other miscellaneous type permitting activities, and through that 60 days under that, this would with this going to 30 days, there was some concern that this 30 days would override the 60-day provision. Now, the 60-day provision, it's in statute that allows them to go to the 60 days, and that the current law says that if it's required by statute, that it's a longer time period. This was to clean up any confusion over that, over whether it's 30 days or 60 days, and this says that the local governments still have 60 days, even though this says 30 days. Because it may not be construed as a requirement. It may be construed as just permission to go to 60 days.
I see. So, Mr. Chairman?
Senator Latz.
So the section 15.99, that's the 60-day provision?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Latz, yes.
Okay.
All right. Any other questions about the amendment? Senator Latz?
Mr. Chairman, I had a question. Also, perhaps for Mr. Lightfoot, but this is a pretty significant addition to Section 9, Subdivision 10. And so, I know it's an author's amendment, but this is not the Committee of Original Jurisdiction.
That's
so
correct.
We don't simply adopt the amendment out of courtesy to the author. We have a responsibility to
That's correct, Senator
analyze Lewis. It and determine if it's an amendment that we think ought to, as a matter of law, be included in the underlying bill. And so, having not read that line by line, perhaps Mr. Lightfoot can explain what the process would be without this amendment. If there are two different search rari routes to be taken for different type of agency or municipal decisions, why those different routes are provided for in current law, and why there should be a unified route within this particular area of environmental impact statements.
Mr. Lightfoot.
Mr. Chair, Senator Latz, this was an issue that I personally have discussed with the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy and a number of other groups that bring these types of actions. If the Court of Appeals were to take jurisdiction over an administrative determination such as an environmental review decision, it is likely that the Court of Appeals would consider that appeal or that review to be one that would have to be made by a petition for certiorari to the Court of Appeals because it is a quasi-judicial decision. Because it is a quasi-judicial decision and it is likely that it would require a petition for certiorari, you would typically expect that the petition process that one would use would be that process that's set forth under the Minnesota Administrative Procedure Act. Unfortunately, the Minnesota Administrative Procedure Act applies by definition only to state agencies or agencies with state jurisdictions. Under the Minnesota Environmental Policy Act, as you know, a number of local governmental units act as a responsible governmental unit or may act as a responsible governmental unit under MEPA to make an environmental review determination. Under statute, under Section 60 or Chapter 606 of the Minnesota statutes, the procedure is essentially the same or somewhat similar, but some of the deadlines are different. For example, under Section 606, the petition for the writ must be served 60 days after the petition is filed rather than 30 days after the petition is filed in the Court of Appeals if it is a local governmental unit as opposed to a state agency. There are other differences in the procedure which, quite frankly, and I have dealt with Chapter 606 in my practice, quite frankly, don't make a lot of sense. And so the Minnesota APA, the Minnesota Administrative Procedure Act, procedure for obtaining a writ of certiorari in the Court of Appeals is well understood. And based upon all of the input that we have received with respect to the procedure, there was a desire to ensure that this procedure be consistent and not vary just because one responsible governmental unit might be the city of Minneapolis and another responsible governmental unit might be the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. So it is really designed to deal with consistency and clarity. And I agree that the language that's offered here in Section 9 looks to be quite long. But in fact, that language is drawn verbatim from the Minnesota Administrative Procedure Act. And the rationale was to ensure that the process be clearly set forth in the Minnesota Environmental Policy Act rather than just referencing or cross-referencing the Minnesota Administrative Procedure Act. Because we were concerned that if there was a simple cross-reference, there may be a question as to whether the Minnesota APA applied to a local government, that it was a responsible governmental unit. So hopefully that's clear, but I'm happy to answer any additional questions that the chair or any other members of the committee or Senator Latz, you may have.
Senator Latz.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, Mr. Lightfoot. So you have chosen the APA language that has the 30-day deadline rather than the Chapter 606 language that has a 60-day deadline for filing that petition for certiorari. Is that right? And why?
Mr. Chair, Senator Latz, that's correct. And it is in part because that right now, the Minnesota Environmental Policy Act requires that an action be filed in district court within 30 days after a decision has been made. So the 30-day requirement is consistent with agency practice, and this looks more like an administrative decision than a conditional use permit decision, for example, by a local governmental unit, number one. And number two, it's consistent with the current time frame, a 30-day time frame to bring an action.
Senator Latz?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Lightfoot, so the action, as in the underlying bill, would still go to the Court of Appeals rather than to a district court. Is that right?
Mr. Lightfoot.
Mr. Chair, Senator Latz, that is correct.
Thank you. And Mr. Chairman.
Senator Latz.
Has the Center for Environmental Advocacy or any other organizations that you've had conversations with, are they in agreement that this is the appropriate procedural route to take, or are they not involved in this discussion?
Mr. Chair, Senator Latz, Senator Latz, the Minnesota, Scott Strand, who is the executive director for the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, specifically called me after he saw the language of the bill as it was written and raised the question about the process. He and I have had numerous discussions about this, and they are, although to use Mr. Strand's words, they are agnostic on whether jurisdiction should be in the district court or in the Court of Appeals. They are absolutely adamant, as we are, that a single certiorari, writ of certiorari petition process be followed, no matter whether there is a local governmental unit that is the RGU or a state agency that is the RGU.
Okay. So they want, Mr. Chairman, they want a unified approach to this.
Mr. Chair, Senator Latz, they want consistency, as does the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Yes.
Okay. And then, Senator Latz. Mr. Chairman, this also goes to the underlying section of the bill that this relates to, which is the advisability of changing the jurisdiction for review from the district court to the Court of Appeals. Any of the witnesses, perhaps Mr. Lightfoot's most appropriate for this question as well, is what difference, if any, would there be between the present role of the district court in reviewing these matters and the proposed role of the Court of Appeals in reviewing these matters?
Mr. Lightfoot.
Mr. Chair, Senator Latz, the rationale for moving jurisdiction from the district court to the Court of Appeals is essentially twofold. First, the Minnesota legislature created an intermediate appellate court, the Court of Appeals, in 1983. Based upon the research that I have done, the jurisdiction of the district court under the Minnesota Environmental Policy Act seems to be anachronistic. This is a quasi-judicial decision made on an administrative record, and it doesn't make a whole lot of sense for the district court to evaluate an administrative record prepared by a responsible governmental unit under the same standard of review that the Court of Appeals would apply, and then have the Court of Appeals do exactly the same thing. So the short answer to your question is the rationale for moving jurisdiction from the district court to the Court of Appeals is that both courts do exactly the same thing, except that in the last environmental review case that I had that went to the Court of Appeals, it took a year and a half to get through the district court and then another year in the Court of Appeals before we finally got a decision. The rationale is to avoid the judicial duplication of the same administrative record being considered under the same legal standard by two separate state courts.
And Mr. Chairman, Mr. Lightfoot, could you explain what that legal standard of review is then?
Mr. Chair, Senator Latz, the standard of review is the standard under the Minnesota Administrative Procedure Act, which is another reason we chose that process for a petition for review. It is the arbitrary and capricious standard, which means that the court evaluates the agency's or the responsible governmental unit's determination based upon the administrative record to determine whether the agency's decision or the responsible governmental unit's decision is arbitrary and capricious based upon that record, not otherwise in accordance with law or otherwise unsupported by substantial evidence in the administrative record. So it is a record review. In the district court, there is no testimony taken. It is based upon the administrative record that is developed by the responsible governmental unit during the environmental review process.
So, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Lightfoot, there is no evidence creation or gathering at the district court. There's no extended hearings or testimony in the district court presently. It's just a review of a previously created record.
Mr. Chair, Senator Latz, that is absolutely correct. I have had a number of these cases representing responsible governmental units, plaintiffs, and project proposers as interveners. The cases are resolved in the district court on cross motions for summary judgment because there's no testimony taken. There's no trial. There are no extended hearings. The only hearing in district court on these cases is the hearing on the cross motions for summary judgment. But again, because some district courts are busy and it takes some time for responsible governmental units to prepare administrative records in some cases, it can take quite a while before the case actually gets through the district court.
So, Mr. Chairman?
Senator Latz.
Then what is, aside from what you're describing as an essential duplication of the process of review, is there any other rationale that's being proposed for moving this to the Court of Appeals?
Mr. Lightfoot?
Mr. Chair, Senator Latz, the issue is the duplication of effort of the district court, number one, and number two, this looks more like an administrative decision, a quasi-judicial administrative decision, over which the Court of Appeals now has exclusive jurisdiction. So it is both to avoid duplication of review, expedite review, and include that evaluation in the Court of Appeals.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Lightfoot, would it not also be the case then that you have judges in the Court of Appeals who are farther removed both geographically and in other ways from the locale of the proposed development or whatever the project is that's subject to the environmental review?
Mr. Lightfoot.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Latz, first, that is true with respect to the Court of Appeals when the Pollution Control Agency issues an environmental permit, for example, or the Department of Natural Resources issues a permit, or the Department of Agriculture issues a permit. The district court does not have any jurisdiction over those permits. Jurisdiction is exclusively in the Court of Appeals, number one. And number two, with respect to the question of the court being geographically removed, there is certainly the ability for the Court of Appeals to hear this type of appeal, as they could in any type of appeal, outstate if it came to that. But the important thing to note is that citizen participation here is exclusively limited to comments on during the environmental review process, made in the administrative record, and hearings before the responsible governmental unit. There's no testimony taken at the district court level in these cases. It cannot. It is record review.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will tell the committee that I looked at the bill before this amendment came forward, and I was very pleased to see this amendment on subdivision 10, because it really did clear up about a good number of questions that I had with respect to the process of appealing and challenging what was going to go on if a contest were to come up. And I will say that Senator Latz has really quite thoroughly gone through most of the remaining questions that I had. But I do have just two very quick questions. As far as I'm concerned, in looking at the judicial review process, Mr. Lightfoot, I think that the amendment really does help the bill a great deal. But my two questions are these to Mr. Lightfoot. I don't remember the specifics of 14.63 to 14.68. That's on your amendment line 1.20. And it is the intent here that the judicial review referred to at line 1.19 is to go right to the Court of Appeals. You're not going through OAH. Is that correct?
That, Mr. Chair, Senator Newman, that is correct. These are the judicial review provisions that are set forth in the Minnesota Administrative Procedure Act, but the Office of Administrative Hearing is not involved in environment and never has been involved in environmental review matters.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Newman.
Then my second question, line 1.31, 1.32, Mr. Lightfoot, of the amendment talks in terms of the filing of the writ, et cetera, and then talks the governmental unit may stay enforcement or the Court of Appeals may order. Is it the intent of the amendment that the governmental unit would have the ability to issue an order staying enforcement?
Mr. Lightfoot?
Mr. Chair, Senator Newman, short answer to that is yes. The important thing is under the the amendment, but also under the Minnesota Rules of Civil Appellate Procedure, when a stay is requested from the Court of Appeals, typically the stay is first directed either to the responsible, either to the administrative agency or to a district court. And so for consistency purposes with the Minnesota Rules of Civil Appellate Procedure, it was important that the responsible governmental unit first have the opportunity to stay the effect of its own action. If it does not, then the Court of Appeals has the ability to review that decision as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Marty, on the amendment.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Lightfoot, I was listening to this. I'm not an attorney and so on. I just wondered, I understand the concern about duplication. I just know that I keep thinking last year we had some people from a dairy up in Thief River Falls who were fighting. I mean, it was clearly a violation of a permit and so on. And I just know the hassle they had coming down to St. Paul to deal with it. And I see a letter here from Farmers Union explaining their concern about people traveling for a long distance. Why don't you, if you want to have one, if you want to get rid of duplication, if it's purely duplication, why not have it done in the district court? Because I think in a lot of these cases, or have it the choice of one or the other, but not both, because I think a lot of times a lot of these fights are very local fights and trying to get people to deal with it in St. Paul is a lot more difficult. And I think this letter is basically saying the same thing. So I understand your concern if it truly is duplicative, but why not pick the local one?
Mr. Lightfoot.
Mr. Chair, Senator Marty, the district court has jurisdiction, or the Court of Appeals has exclusive jurisdiction over quasi-judicial decisions like this, permit decisions that the Pollution Control makes, that the Department of Natural Resources makes, that the Department of Agriculture makes. No matter where those decisions are made, no matter where those permits are issued in the state, that's a determination that this legislature has made. That's a determination that that's where the acts are, or that's where the actions are set under the Minnesota Administrative Procedure Act. It just seems to make for consistency purposes, it makes the most sense to have this kind of decision, which looks very similar to those types of decisions, be included in the Court of Appeals or be addressed and reviewed in the Court of Appeals. The other concern is that if a decision goes exclusively to district court, I'm not sure that the legislature could do this constitutionally, but right now there is an automatic right of appeal from the district court to the Court of Appeals. So venuing it in the district court, frankly, has been the problem rather than the solution. And as I said, with respect to the Farmers Union and other individuals who are outstate, there is an ability for the Court of Appeals to hear those cases outstate. But fundamentally, the way Farmers Union participates in the process and the way that all citizens participate and anyone participates in the process is by making comments and attending public hearings on the environmental review, during the environmental review decision. Once that decision is made, the court doesn't hear from the citizens anymore. The court hears from the citizens' lawyers.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Marty.
One follow-up on that. I hear you say the legislature determined that the Administrative Procedure Act should be handled exclusively by the Appeals Court, and I mean, well, the legislature also decided these would be heard in district court. I mean, you're saying, well, now we should have you decide to do what you've already decided for the other ones, and maybe there's, I mean, I understand your reason for that. I also hear others saying that that's not a good idea. And I guess I'm also not sure about your comment that they do have the right to appeal it. I mean, do they, if this goes to the appeals court, can they appeal that to the Supreme Court?
Mr. Chair, Senator Marty, let me answer the last question first. There is an ability to petition for review in the Minnesota Supreme Court. Petitions for review are discretionary as opposed to an absolute right of appeal from the district court. Fundamentally, and I've thought about this. I've done a fair amount of research, so let me put my adjunct professor hat on for a moment. I honestly believe that the legislature, when it created the Court of Appeals in 1983 and amended a number of statutes to remove district court and substitute it with Court of Appeals jurisdiction, including the Minnesota Administrative Procedure Act, simply missed this one. I think it is a historic anachronism that needs to be corrected.
But, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Lightfoot, when you said that if you gave it just to the district court, they'd have no right to appeal, but they'd have a right to appeal to Supreme Court, perhaps, you're just saying they don't have to hear the case, whereas the appeals court does have to hear the case?
Mr. Lightfoot.
Mr. Chair, Senator Marty, yes. I mean, I suppose in theory that the legislature could eliminate Court of Appeals jurisdiction in Minnesota Environmental Policy Act cases, but that's not what this legislation does. In theory, the legislature could eliminate that, I suppose, so long as there is a due process right to file a petition for review in the Minnesota Supreme Court.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, are you saying, though, that in the practice we've had in the past, that if one of these, that a decision made in district court is appealed to the appeals court and it never changes? I mean, have they always accepted the district court ruling, or have they overturned it at some points?
Mr. Chair, Senator Marty, the district court certainly has been reversed. The point, though, is not that there will be any changes in the outcome of these cases by sending the matter to the Court of Appeals in the first instance. The point is that the district court and the Court of Appeals do exactly the same thing. They evaluate exactly the same record on exactly the same standard of review, applying exactly the same law.
They do come up with different results at times, so you're saying. They do overturn them.
Mr. Lightfoot.
Mr. Chair, Senator Marty, the standard of review here is the arbitrary and capricious standard, which means that a responsible governmental unit has to act arbitrarily and capriciously on its own administrative record. Certainly there have been cases that the Court of Appeals has reversed when the district court has made a finding that a responsible governmental unit failed to act properly. There have certainly been those cases. But in the great majority of these cases, because of the standard of review, the responsible governmental unit's decision is upheld.
Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Lightfoot. I want to make sure I understand this correctly. Typically, we think of the district courts, lay people, and most of us think of the district courts as the place where testimony is taken, et cetera. What you're describing here is this is an administrative procedure where all the testimony is taken at the administrative level. Therefore, when the district court hears it, they're actually kind of functioning as a court of appeals, but since there's a right to go to the Minnesota Court of Appeals, which has original jurisdiction, literally that district court judge's judgment is irrelevant because they're not irrelevant if it's appealed, because a court of appeals can exercise completely its own judgment on legal issues, not factual issues, but legal issues. So in this instance, the trial, quote, trial, or actually argument, summary judgment argument in the trial court is literally of no effect because the record's already been made and the Court of Appeals is going to hear it anyway.
Mr. Lightfoot.
Mr. Chair, Senator Thompson, that is correct. And I would go one step further and just remind the non-lawyers on the committee that a lawyer cannot raise a new legal argument in the Court of Appeals. So literally the same, not only is it the same record and the same standard of review, it is the same legal arguments. The lawyers cannot raise new arguments in the Court of Appeals.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is there further discussion? Senator Lantz.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Mr. Lightfoot, there are other pieces to this A11 amendment. One of those pieces, beginning 1.36, changes the language anyway, relating to the decision whether or not a bond may be required, changing it from essentially the standards required for issuance of a temporary restraining order to language of is likely to succeed on the merits. Could you please explain what the effect of that language change would be on the decision whether to require a bond for a petitioner?
Mr. Chair, Senator Latz, the reason that the language deleting the reference to temporary restraining order, the reason that language was deleted is to avoid any confusion because the Court of Appeals does not issue temporary restraining orders, only the district court does. There's no intent to change the standard under Section 562.02 or under the former language in the Minnesota Environmental Policy Act.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Lance.
Thank you, Mr. Lightfoot. There is more extensive language in the case law for the question of whether to issue a temporary restraining order than only is likely to succeed. So why don't you – I don't understand why there would be a – why you're saying there would be no difference in the standard. I mean, there's a five-point test for a TRO to be issued, and you have reduced the language just to one of those 5 points. Sounds to me like there's a substantive difference, and the Court of Appeals is quite capable and used to reviewing the standards for TROs that are issued, so they're well aware of it and would be capable of applying it, even if they don't ordinarily issue them themselves.
Is that a question, Senator?
Why reduce... Why eliminate four out of the five TRO standards?
Mr. Lightfoot?
Mr. Chair, Senator Latz, the most important, there is certainly, well, I remember four standards for a TRO. I don't know if there's a fifth one. There may be. It's been a while since I've been to law school. But the rationale is that the likelihood of success on the merits is the most important of the requirements for obtaining a temporary restraining order. One could certainly include the other four, I suppose, and include a reference to a balancing test. But typically, the courts focus on the likelihood of success on the merits, and if there's no likelihood of success on the merits, they don't go to the other three tests. They only go to balancing if there is a likelihood of success on the merits.
Senator Latz.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it just seems to me that the effect of this is probably to reduce the standard necessary to avoid posting a bond. And the bond has a very significant reason for existing. It's to protect the parties that were not making the appeal in the event of any financial loss resulting from the appeal, or in this case, a petition for certiorari. So it's an awfully significant component to this law. I would be nervous about changing that standard in any way. There is one other piece of this amendment I had a question about, and that's on line 2.5 of the amendment relating to who may intervene as of right in a proceeding. And under present law, the board that initiates the judicial review may intervene as of right in any proceeding. And you're proposing to add the project proposer to that intervention as of right. Could you explain the significance of that, please?
Mr. Lightfoot?
Mr. Chair, Senator Latz, the rationale is that unlike in federal court, under the federal rules of appellate procedure, there is no process for the project proposer to intervene in the Court of Appeals. There is a process for the project proposer to intervene in district courts. Project proposers often intervene in district courts, almost always as a matter of right because it is their project. And so the rationale here was just to provide an ability for a project proposer to intervene, to be involved in the litigation with respect to that project.
So, Mr. Chairman, so this would give the project proposer in the Court of Appeals the same ability to participate in the legal argument as they presently have in the district court?
Mr. Lightfoot?
Mr. Chair, Senator Latz, that's correct.
All right.
Any further discussion?
Not of the amendment, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Senator Ingebrigtsen renews his motion to amend Senate File 42 with the A11 amendment.
Mr. Chairman, I move for a recorded vote on this.
All right. Be a roll call vote.
And ask to have it recorded in the Senate Journal.
I think you need three votes to request that, Senator Latz.
I'm not sure if I do in committee. Perhaps counsel could say.
Counsel? Council is nodding yes.
To which one of us, Mr. Chairman?
To which
Chairman?
One of us? To me or to Senator Lyons?
Mr. Chairman, members, my recollection is that it's true. It is three votes, but we can check on that if you'd like.
Does that mean that? Oh, never mind. We can determine that later. Since it's a recorded vote, it could be recorded in a permanent record of the Senate. We'll proceed with the vote. Roll call has been requested.
Senator Thompson?
Yes.
Senator Hall?
Yes.
Senator Marty?
No.
Senator Jungbauer?
Yes.
Senator Ortman?
Yes.
Senator Latz?
No.
Senator Newman?
Yes.
Senator Limmer?
Yes.
Senator Hoffman?
Yes.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Yes.
The amendment passes 7-3. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And with that, I would like to move the bill.
Move the bill.
Yeah.
Before we do that, Senator Ingebrigtsen, is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to speak for or against this bill? I would like the members to know that there's a letter from the Minnesota Farmers Union. They could not be here, but they submitted a letter in your file, and they are on record of opposing the section of Senate File 42 that moves a decision on the need for an environmental impact statement for a proposed project from district court to the Court of Appeals. Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry I was late. I had a meeting, and I don't know if you discussed Senate Counsel's list of judiciary issues, Section 7. I think that's the one where the proposer can draft their own EIS, and in effect they have it done privately, and I guess it looks to me like the issue is the data and whether that data is public. Was that discussed at all, and what was the conclusion, if so? Is that?
I don't believe we did discuss that, did we?
Well, I'm just curious that because that seems to be a judiciary. In other words, if I'm trying to get a project approved and I decide to do under this section, my understanding of it is that I can hire somebody to do my own EIS to submit to the do my own environmental impact statement. And the question I have is, we had this discussion under the data practices request the other day, if I think Mr. Gemberling pointed out, like when a private party is dealing with communication stuff and so on, does the data transfer the way Data Practices Act requires. Is that clear in here that any data that's provided as part of this, if somebody else wants to review that, that I'd have access to that the same way I'd have access if DCA or whoever did the environmental impact statement?
Senator Ingebrigtsen? Do you have any comment?
Mr. Chairman, Tony Quillen again from the Department of Natural Resources. Mr. Chairman, Tony Quillen from the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Senator Marty, the intent is right now with the environmental impact statement, allowing the proposer to contract directly with the consultant. We think we can save time and cost on the front end of proposing a preliminary draft environmental impact statement. And as you'll see in there, in lines 12, I'm not sure with the amendment, but 12.21 through 12.27, all the information used shall be submitted as an appendix on all studies and all other information used to substantiate the analysis contained in the draft environmental impact statement will be public. And the intent, again, the intent is the same data that exchanges between when a RGU, a regulatory governmental unit, a contractor, and the project proposer is the intent is to also exchange that information and make that public.
Sir Marty?
Mr. Chairman, yeah, I'm not sure this is a good provision, but in other words, my specific question here is that data is, and again, I'm not thinking, I'm trying to figure out what all it is, but the intent is, and not being the lawyer, I'm not sure if this covers everything, but basically, all the documents are going into the environmental impact study, environmental impact statement would be public, the same as it would be otherwise. So the only issue then is should the proposer be contracting with the person or should the agency? Because, okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Further discussion, Senator Latz?
The amendment that this committee adopted changed line 12.20 to make it a preliminary draft EIS, and same with line 12.23. Does the word preliminary have any significance in terms of its data practices effect?
Senator Ingebrigtsen or Mr. Colas?
Mr. Chairman, I would defer to counsel in terms of whether it's preliminary or the draft.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Latz, no, I mean, it doesn't have any impact. I think it was just intended to emphasize that it is really just a preliminary draft, so it's something that the project proposer might prepare just as a starting point for the government unit. So it doesn't affect the data access at all.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Latz.
If the responsible governmental unit were to contract with a private consultant to prepare an analysis for a draft EIS, does the fact that the contract is with the responsible governmental unit by itself bring the consultant's data within the coverage of the Data Practices Act?
Counsel?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Latz, if there's a contract, then it does come under the Data Practices Act. If they're basically sort of privatizing what would be their function, then under the Data Practices Act, the contract has to include a provision that brings it under. But if there's not a contract, which is, I understand, the anticipation here is that this would not be a contractual relationship with the government entity, but rather would be just a preliminary draft that the project proposer would put together. Then if there's not a contract, then the Data Practices Act doesn't kick in.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Latz.
That raises the obvious follow-up question is what about this bill, then, if not a contractual obligation, does bring a project proposer's data collected by a contract consultant within the coverage of the Data Practices Act?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Latz, the only thing that would do that is if you look in the bill, once the data goes to the responsible government unit and is in their hands, then whatever they get is subject to the Data Practices Act. So whatever the project proposer submits, which you'll, if you look on the bill on 12.21, it says that it has to include as an appendix studies and other sources of information used to substantiate the analysis. So that much would then be in the hands of the government entity and would be subject to the Data Practices Act. Now, it's possible that there might be other data that the project proposer had that wasn't included there that would still be not government data. But whatever went to the government entity would be government data.
Mr. Chairman? So if the project proposer's hand-selected consultant chose to not utilize certain data they had in their possession as a part of their analysis for their proposed EIS, for whatever reason, for example, the cynic in me might say, because it didn't support the outcome they were seeking, then that data would not be covered by Data Practices Act and would never become public? Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Letts, that's correct. It would only be what they submitted to the government entity. Assuming there's no contractual relationship with the government entity, they're just submitting this.
So, Mr. Chairman?
Senator Letts.
Then if a responsible governmental unit, as a responsible governmental body, wanted to perhaps act responsibly skeptical about a project proposer's own environmental impact statement, they would almost have a duty to separately contract with a consultant to gather their own data, because they wouldn't or they shouldn't automatically trust a project proposer to give all of the data, including the data that might not support the project that's being proposed. It seems to me, Mr. Chairman, we have the classic case of the fox guarding the chicken coop for that reason. And, I mean, there have been plenty of instances in the public realm, in the media, and so on, where data has been ignored in submissions by, for example, pharmaceutical companies to the FDA to seeking approval. Data which they didn't like or which didn't support the outcomes that they wanted, that would have been beneficial to the government to know in order to make an intelligent and objective decision. I'm not saying everyone would do this, but I think there's a natural tendency for a contractor or consultants, especially if they hope to regularly get the contracts from large corporations that are proposing large projects that have an environmental impact, to shade the tenor of their proposed report and perhaps ignore some of the underlying data that doesn't advance the position of the people that are paying their bill. And so I think that's a significant deficiency in this bill before us. It has the effect of shielding as non-public data possibly very significant information for the determination.
Senator Letts?
And would end up duplicating resources because a responsible government unit would have to do the same thing themselves.
Senator Letts, there's an A9 amendment that you might be interested in offering. I'm going to give you a copy of the A9 amendment and see if that might alleviate your concern.
Mr. Chairman?
And we can pass out the A9 amendment to everyone, including you, Senator Ingbritson. Go ahead,
Mr.
Senator
Chairman,
Ingbritson.
Thank you. Before that, Senator Letts, maybe lines 12.23 through 27 may cover what you're talking about. Does it make it a little more clear?
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Letts.
Well, saying shall, if needed, turns shall into may. I'm not sure that that would address that concern, Mr. Chairman.
Need to give the author. Senator Jungbauer, while we're thinking about that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to answer some of Senator Latz's concerns, having been through this many times in real life and studying EISs and actually working for an organization that puts these together in preliminary and all the way through to end environmental impact statements, there is a process under Latz, and it's very detailed out as to how those go together. And in fact, quite to the contrary of what you talk about, I see government agencies over and over coming up with studies to try to subvert the process. In fact, older studies that may have something new that's come out that the government agencies ignore in order to try to shut down a project. And I will use at this legislature, we will see this over and over again in the polymet mining situation where the EPA and the PCA and other regulatory agencies have come out with studies that are ancient, if you will, about contaminatory issues that don't even come into the context of the proposed plan on that one. And I'd be happy to go over that since I've studied those environmental impact statements, EPA and PCA comments on that in particular, to see how far behind the times government agencies are in even understanding what technology can do today and holding up and subverting the process by using studies that are 20 and 30 years outdated. So in point of fact, today, Senator, the government uses that exactly to shut down projects. And so that is the need for people that actually understand what's going on in real life and real technology and real science today to put these together and bring those studies that do reflect modern technology and the modern art of science in order to protect the environment. And Senator and everyone here knows my passion for protecting the environment and knows that I take no pride in having to talk about the PCA and being 20 and 30 years behind in our DNR. But that is exactly what's happening. That is exactly why we need bills like this. That is exactly why I talk about a 90-day process, because quite honestly, members, if somebody can't figure it out in 90 days, they ain't smart enough to figure it out in 150 days. And so I get really passionate about this stuff, and I have seen the government do that over and over and over again in Minnesota to subvert the projects.
The bill is before us. Senator Latz, are you interested in amending?
Mr. Chairman, I'm only reacting to the bill before us. I'm not interested in anything further. But I did have another question.
Senator Latz.
Mr. Chairman, or whoever would answer the question, how would citizens obtain environmental impact statement information from the proposers under this bill?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Colas. Latz, Tony Quillis again from Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. This proposal, the intent is to not take away any authority at all from a regulatory governmental unit. As you'll see on line 12.26, they still have the responsibility to review, modify, or determine the completeness and adequacy of the EIS. The public comment periods will still exist in developing the scoping document, as well as when the draft EIS is put together. The public comment periods will still be there. There is no change at all in public comment periods at all. In terms of what the intent is right now there's a relationship between the regulatory governmental unit, the project proposer, and the consultant. The project proposer pays for all the study, review, modification, and determination of completeness of adequacy here. We don't have a lot of say in that as we're paying that bill. We're just saying all we want to do is prepare a preliminary draft to allow the RGU to review it, determine that it's not adequate, or turn it back to us and tell us that it needs to be modified. And we think that relationship with us and the consultant, where we're paying the bill, and the consultants hate for me to use this analogy, there is no weekends. We're going 24/7. There's no holidays. There's no vacation time. Since we're paying the bill and we have that direct relationship with the consultant, we think we can save time and cost in preparing that preliminary draft environmental impact statement. And in preparing that, we're willing to cough up all the documentation that you're referencing and any more if needed to substantiate the analysis in that draft environmental impact statement.
Any further discussion? Senator Marty?
Mr. Chairman, I wish I was as
confident of what Mr. Quillis is saying, but I just keep thinking this isn't a judiciary issue, so I'll just drop it in a second. But like the next section, within 30 days after approval, local governmental unit has to act on it. Keep thinking a lot of cases where you've got a planning commission and a city council or something, they meet every other week, and you know, if the EIS comes in on a certain date and the planning commission doesn't meet for 3 weeks, you know, you could easily go past it just without any meetings. You couldn't even schedule the meetings fast enough. I'm just saying that I'm afraid that moving these things from like the issue earlier of district court to the appeals court and so on, I think you are not speeding up. You're shortchanging the process, and I don't mind the speeding up if it's not shortchanging, but I have a lot of concerns about that. And
Senator Jungbauer?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Senator Marty's issue, again, having dealt with this for 25 years on construction and development, Senator Marty, when these projects are proposed, and as you're doing the EIS and as you're going through it, every party is aware of what's going on. If they don't have it in process already in their planning, in their zoning, in those issues, I don't even want to say it, but they're just plain stupid. Because that is what holds these things up. That is what makes Minnesota a bad place to do business. Everybody knows, and everybody should be planning this together, and that's how we can put business on the ground. That's how we can move Minnesota forward. So this 30-day period after everything is done, it's not like these guys, whoever the affected party is, the responsible government unit, the city, the county, the state, they all know what's going on, and they need to be planning it simultaneously, and that's part of what this proposal is about. It's about working together to get something done and to protect the environment at the same time.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Marty.
In response, Senator Jungbauer, maybe in terms of you trying to get a project done, I just know I've heard from so many farmers right next to a project who might have some concerns about it, and they're not paying attention to this every day and every minute, and they're not going to all the hearings and everything else. And all of a sudden, they feel they've been blindsided by some proposal, and they didn't have the chance to look it over. And it might be nice if they were having time, full time, to do it. The proposer of the project might, but the neighbors don't always have the time. And I guess that's my concern. I don't think saying that they're stupid is the right approach to it. I think they are maybe very smart people, but just not have the time to track it all the way.
Mr. Chairman, to address Senator Marty's concerns very quickly. In the A11 amendment we adopted, Senator Marty, I've been working with the League of Minnesota Cities, and they have a 60-day timeline there, so we exempted the cities out, and that's what the 1599 section is referenced to. And additionally, in terms of Section 8, where we talk about 90 to 30-day, that provision was also included in the governor's executive order that he issued regarding environmental streamlining and permitting. It was a couple Mondays ago. I can't pull the date off the top of my head, and I apologize.
Senator Ingebrigtsen has moved that Senate file number 42 as amended be recommended to pass.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Lantz.
Some further discussion, if I may. One is just a point, which is regardless of the data practices concerns that I have raised, just the idea that the responsible governmental unit would not be engaging an impartial third party to come up with the draft EIS, but rather would be reacting to the draft of a potentially bought and paid for EIS from the project proposer. I think just the whole concept of that is troublesome. But I have a different question. I understand that there will be a fiscal impact on the courts. And that hasn't been brought up yet. We are a committee of both policy and budget jurisdiction. And I wonder if there's a completed fiscal impact note
Mr. Turner?
For this bill.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members. The fiscal note does point out the workload shift from the district courts to the Court of Appeals. It actually nets out with small annual savings to the court system overall. I spoke to the state court administrator this afternoon, and she said that the courts are not going to request a corresponding shift in appropriations to reflect that the appeals court is simply going to absorb the added workload.
So, Mr. Chairman?
Senator Letts.
Is the fiscal impact, the fiscal note completed so it can be distributed to the committee members?
Mr. Turner?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Letts, it's a preliminary fiscal note. However, the court portion of it is considered signed off on. And I can, you know, I can show it to you if you like, but we didn't distribute it because the majority of the fiscal note has to do with the other parts of the bill. And there was a new engrossment. That note was requested today. I was told that the court portion of the note, it remains the same. I can show this to you if you'd like. What it shows is a $74,000 annual savings to the district courts as you cost out the workload shift, and a $62,000 annual cost to the appeals court for a $12,000 annual net savings to the court system as a whole. And, of course, when they cost it out, it's a workload shift is what it is, and the court has decided to not ask for a corresponding appropriation shift.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Latz.
I'm not sure what the appropriate process is. I suspect that we have a responsibility to actually have the opportunity to read the court's analysis, each one of the members of the committee to read the fiscal analysis on this and to incorporate that into our judgments here. And certainly adding to the cost to the Court of Appeals of 60-some thousand dollars, you know, they can tell us now they can absorb it, which is essentially what they're doing, saying they're just going to either cut somewhere else, I'd like to know where,
Senator Latz,
or they've got the room
Senator Latz,
to absorb it, Mr.
This
Chairman.
This bill has been thoroughly vetted tonight, and we're going to proceed
Mr.
with
Chairman,
the
not fiscally it hasn't. I haven't read the fiscal note, Mr. Chairman. I think as a member of the Finance Committee in this jurisdiction, I have a right to see it, analyze it, have time to ask questions about it, and so does each member of this committee.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you. I thought maybe you might have forgotten me there.
No.
Mr. Chair, is a motion to call the question in order?
Yes.
Then, Mr. Chair, respectfully, I move to call the question.
Request a roll call vote.
Roll call has been requested. Roll call will be filed. Senator Ingebrigtsen renews his motion, and moving Senate file number 42 as amended be recommended to pass and move to the Senate Finance Committee. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
All those in favor say aye.
Roll call.
Aye.
Roll call, Mr. Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry. A roll call.
Senator Thompson.
Yes.
Senator Hall.
Yes.
Senator Marty.
No.
Senator Jungbauer.
Yes.
Senator Ortman.
Yes.
Senator Latz.
No.
Senator Newman.
Yes.
Senator Limmer.
Yes.
Senator Hoffman.
Yes.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Yes.
Vote is 6-4. The amendment passes.
Mr. Chairman,
members.
Oh, Mr. Chair, I think that was the motion passed, but we still have not voted on the bill.
Oh, sorry.
That we just did.
I'll call the question.
Vote on the question.
That's what we did.
Vote on the call.
Sorry.
So that was
I passed, Mr. Chair. Excuse me.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Latz?
I'd like the record to reflect that about 2 seconds before the vote was taken, I was handed the fiscal impact note. I have not had an opportunity to review it at all prior to making this decision, and to my understanding, no member of the committee has had that opportunity prior to making this decision.
I was told, Senator Ortman, that you may be correct after all, and that the vote that you questioned was a vote on your motion and not on the bill. So we will renew the motion that Senator Ingebrigtsen has moved that Senate file number 42 as amended be recommended to pass.
Request a roll call.
And be moved to Senate Finance Committee. Roll call will be taken.
Mr. Chair, just to clarify, our previous roll call vote was on the motion to call the question. And now our roll call is on passage of the bill to the
That's
Finance
correct.
Committee.
As amended.
Mr. Chairman. As amended.
And Mr. Chairman, I was confused, and I have no objection to having the vote come up now, so I was not opposed to your thing. I thought we were voting on the bill.
All right. Roll call, please.
Senator Thompson.
Yes.
Senator Hall.
Yes.
Senator Marty.
No.
Senator Jungbauer.
Yes.
Senator Ortman.
Yes.
Senator Latz.
No.
Senator Newman.
Yes.
Senator Limmer.
Yes.
Senator Hoffman?
Yes.
Senator Ingebrigtsen?
Yes.
The motion does pass 8-2, and the amendment or the bill is.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Senator Ingebrigtsen. The next bill before us is Senate File 33. Senator Hamm.
We all do.
Good luck.
Welcome to the committee, I think, Senator Hamm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members, and it's nice to be in front of the Judiciary Committee. And Senator Lemmer, I just have to comment that I don't know if this is the first time in the history, but when you and I served on the Judiciary Committee, it was about an even split between lawyers and non-lawyers, but now on your committee, it looks like it's like 2-1. The non-lawyers are winning. I thought maybe if Senator Jungbauer and Senator Thompson switched places, the legal section would be right there. We could focus on them for our arguments. But
well, Senator Hand, don't say anything against the lawyers because I need their votes in other things. So.
No one's ever against a lawyer when you need one. We all know that.
Mr. Chairman, I think Senator Hand has been accused in other committees of practicing law without a license.
Yeah. And, we can review that bill, too.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Latz, it certainly would be true I don't have a license.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members, Senate File 33 is very, I believe, straightforward. It's not too lengthy. I want to give you a brief overview of what is contained in the bill. I understand we do have some people who would like to testify. What we're calling this is the Freedom of Choice and Health Care Act. And in Section 1, Subdivision 2 through defines the terms health care service, mode of securing, and penalty. Subdivision 3, paragraph A, is the statement of the public policy of the state of Minnesota that the power to require or regulate a person's choice of in the mode of securing health care services or to impose a penalty related to that choice is not found in the U.S. Constitution, and that the state hereby exercises its sovereign power to declare the right of all persons residing in the state in choosing their mode of securing health care services. Paragraph B states that the public policy of the state of Minnesota is that every resident is free to choose or decline to choose any mode of securing health care services without penalty or threat of penalty. Paragraph C states that this policy is not to be applied to impair any right of contract related to the provision of health care services. And Subdivision 4 states that no public official, employee, or agent of the state or any of its political subdivisions shall act to impose, collect, enforce, or effectuate any penalty that violates the public policy set forth in this section. It also requires the Attorney General to take any action as provided in this section or in the Minnesota Statute, Section 8.31, to defend or prosecute the rights protected under this section. And then further, Section 2 requires the Attorney General to seek injunctive and any other appropriate relief to preserve the rights and property of the residents of the state and to defend the state's officials, employees, and agents in the event that there is a law or regulation that violates the public policy. This also requires the Attorney General to seek injunctive and any other appropriate relief in the event that any law or regulation that violates this policy is enacted without adequate federal funding to the state. And then Section 3, Mr. Chairman and members, repeals the early extension of medical assistance, which probably is not within the jurisdiction of your committee, but that is what the Act does. We are bringing this because we believe that it is important for the state of Minnesota, given the conditions of federal policy on health care, for us to make it clear that we believe that the right to govern health care is exclusively a state within the state's jurisdiction and not within the federal government's jurisdiction. And to protect the rights of the people of Minnesota, either directly as individuals or through the power of their elected representatives in the legislature, the Minnesota legislature, to determine what those policies ought to be. And we are concerned, given the last year and a half of our experience with what the federal government has done in health care policy, that their actions, we believe, or I believe, have been in violation of that traditional separation of power, that traditional limit on federal power. And it is important that we as a state make it clear that it is our public policy that we do not agree with that direction, and that we are going to do everything within our power constitutionally to retain the rights of our citizens and our state to act on health care matters. And so, Mr. Chairman, I don't know if you want to take questions right now or you want to hear additional testimony, but that's what the bill is about, and I would respectfully ask your support.
Senator Hand, before we move into further testimony, I'm going to ask ask counsel to tell us what are the sections of jurisdiction that this committee is considering this evening. Ms. Pontius.
Mr. Chair, members, basically it's sections 1 and 2.
Senator Hand, any other testimony?
Well,
who would like
Chairman,
to be first?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman.
Who would like to be first?
Mr. Chairman, I understand we've got three witnesses that would like to present to the committee, and we can certainly take them in the order on your agenda if
right.
You'd like.
Will Twyla Brace approach the witness table? Ms. Brace, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Twyla Brace. I'm president of the Citizens Council for Health Freedom. And for those of you who have heard me testify before, you might notice that that is a different name. We recently changed our name. The other thing I want to say before I begin is that had we had the hearing at 1 o'clock, there were approximately 30 people here that were in support, but of course they couldn't stay. So I just wanted that to be on the record. Let me just begin by saying that I am pleased to come today on behalf of our organization to support Senate File 33, the Freedom of Choice in Healthcare Act. A version of this act has been enacted in 6 states and embedded in the state constitutions of 2 states. Freedom is the essence of America, and the right to be free within is the essence of being an American. Freedom of choice in healthcare is especially critical because the provision of healthcare services makes a difference on the individual's life and their quality of life. The right to pay for care denied by insurance or government programs is also critically important. Patients must never have their hands tied or their lives jeopardized by laws that restrict private payments and private contracts. That said, unbeknownst to many citizens, perhaps even to you, in 1997, Congress forbid private payment by Medicare patients for care denied by Medicare. In short, if you are 65 or older, your cash can no longer be used to pay for care you want and need unless the doctor drops participation in Medicare. So if a Medicare participating doctor takes the patient's money, the doctor could be accused of defrauding the government. So in light of the $500 billion cut to Medicare through the federal health care reform law and the expected rationing of treatment, Senate File 33 could stand as a legal source of hope for seniors whose care is being denied and whose cash is being refused. I am pleased to see that Senate File 33 acknowledges the ultimate law of the land, the U.S. Constitution, and the prescribed sovereignty of individuals and states within it. As you know, the U.S. Constitution expressly limits what the federal government can do. However, the 2,700-page federal health reform law, which is expected to lead to an additional 250,000 pages of new government regulations, violates those limits, expanding federal controls over the most private decisions of our lives, including choice of medical treatments, choice of doctor, and choice of insurance. Senator Hand's legislation stands up against this federal encroachment, protecting the constitutional rights of Minnesota families, individuals, and patients over medical and insurance decisions. Senate File 33 also preserves the private contract between patient and doctor and patient and hospital. Whereas the federal law unconstitutionally imposes on individuals a mandate to purchase government-prescribed health insurance, regardless of the cost and despite any personal objections to the coverage requirements or the imposed limits on coverage, the Freedom of Choice in Healthcare Act promises to uphold the individual's right to say no to such coverage, including the automatic enrollment of individuals into Medicaid. Senate File 33 will also give individuals the freedom to stay out of the intrusive health insurance exchange and to avoid the IRS penalty for not purchasing government-approved insurance. It will allow individuals to buy health insurance that meets their personal and financial preferences. It will allow patients to pay cash for care and doctors to accept cash for care. Senate File 33 will allow Minnesotans to protect their personal finances from the excesses of federally mandated coverage and costly benefit requirements. It will also allow Minnesotans to keep their health care dollars out of the hands of health plans if they so choose. For those who do not know it yet, the federal health reform bill outlaws traditional high-deductible major medical health insurance for everyone over the age of 29, essentially giving the entire health insurance industry to managed care corporations and mandating that we all purchase their product. This bill gives individuals the freedom to say no to the HMO. Before I conclude, it's particularly important that this committee consider the lawsuits against the federal health reform law. There are approximately 24. Within them are 3 lawsuits that encompass 28 states. Virginia has its own lawsuit. Florida's lawsuit includes 26 states, and Oklahoma recently became the 28th state to sue the federal government. As you may know, on Monday, federal judge Roger Vinson ruled on the 26-state lawsuit against the federal health care reform law. Judge Vinson ruled that the federal mandate to purchase health insurance is unconstitutional. And because the mandate is central to the inner workings of the law, he ruled the entire law invalid and void. You may have read that he stopped short of issuing an injunction to stop implementation of the federal health reform law, but that is not exactly true. Using a quote out of a previous legal decision, Judge Vinson wrote the following on page 75 of the 78-page decision. He wrote, "There is a longstanding presumption that officials of the executive branch will adhere to the law as declared by the court. As a result, the declaratory judgment is the functional equivalent of an injunction," end quote. Thus, at this moment, at least 26 state legislatures have a legal reason to say no to the funding, no to the federal control structures, no to the various mandates, no to the data reporting requirements, no to the employer mandate, and no to the law. We look forward to the possibility of Minnesota being added to that list. Meanwhile, to support the right of citizens to have freedom of choice in health care, Citizens Council for Health Freedom supports Senate File 33, the Freedom of Choice in Health Care Act. Thank you for this opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Ms. Brace. Is there any questions for the witness? Thank you, Ms. Brace. Kim Crockett is on our next on the list. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Crockett.
Thank you.
Good evening. Would you introduce yourself to the committee?
It's a good bill. Organized. It's been a long day for everyone, I think.
Welcome to the Senate Judiciary Committee.
Thank you, Senator Mr. Chair.
We do this every day. And some of us actually enjoy
it.
Yeah,
we love it.
And we love it, yeah.
I won't comment on that.
The freshmen are quietly thinking, what committee did I get onto?
What have I gotten
yeah.
into?
Please proceed.
Well, thank you for inviting me to testify today about Senate File 33, the Freedom of Choice in Health Care Act. I have been writing and speaking about federalism and the Constitution as a leader in the Federalist Society.
Pardon me, Ms. Crockett.
Yes.
Would you state your name
and
the organization you represent into the record, please?
I'm Kim Crockett. I'm President and General Counsel of the Minnesota Free Market Institute and also Chairman of the Federalist Society's Lawyers Chapter here in the state of Minnesota. That's a national organization based out of Washington, D.C., and I included in my remarks the background on those two organizations, if you're interested.
All right. Thank you. Please proceed.
I've been writing and speaking about federalism and the Constitution as a leader in the Federalist Society for many, many years, and more recently as the president of the Minnesota Free Market Institute, which is a nonprofit educational organization dedicated to individual liberty, limited government, and free markets. Now, while most Americans agree that health care reform is vital, the national conversation about reform was cut short by the passage of the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, commonly called Obamacare. I'm going to refer to it as Obamacare this evening because the other one's too long, if nothing else. Obamacare was passed in a rough manner, and to me represented an unprecedented assertion of federal power over states and individuals. So what I'm going to do this evening is briefly outline how Senate File 33 fits into the legal debate surrounding Obamacare, and give you a little bit more of an update on Judge Vinson's ruling that came down Monday in the Florida case, and a little bit more about whether or not he issued an injunction in that ruling. So what does Senate File 33 accomplish? It protects a person's right to participate, or just as importantly, to not participate in a healthcare system, and it prohibits the government from imposing fines or penalties on that person's decision. It also protects the right of individuals to purchase and the right of doctors to provide lawful medical services without government fine or penalty. If you go to Canada and you interfere with that government's monopoly on health care, you can be subject to criminal and civil penalties. So, does Minnesota have the authority to pass something like this? Yes. Minnesota has the authority as a state to provide for the protection of its citizens' individual rights in ways that exceed the protections offered under the United States Constitution. And this includes the right of Minnesotans to control their own medical care. State constitutions and statutes often go beyond what the federal law offers us. And I just would give you an example here in Minnesota. Section 13 of our Constitution grants broader protections against the taking of private property for public use when compared to the Fifth Amendment of the United States Constitution. And while a constitutional amendment would provide protection against future legislative changes, Minnesota has the authority to pass this statute as a response against excessive federal regulation. Some might argue that this statute is an attempt to nullify federal health insurance legislation, but this would be incorrect. Minnesotans would still have the option to participate in federal health insurance programs like Medicaid and the insurance exchanges. This simply protects a person's right not to participate. In other words, it gives Minnesotans the freedom to make healthcare decisions without penalty. Some might also argue that to the extent Senate File 33 conflicts with provisions of federal legislation, the state law is automatically preempted by the Supremacy Clause, which establishes that the Constitution is the supreme law of the land. We've all learned this in our civics courses, and provides that federal laws prevail over conflicting state laws. But this is only true when Congress has the legitimate authority to enact the legislation and where it does not impermissibly tread upon state sovereignty. The federal government, which has immense but limited and enumerated powers, will have to convince the Supreme Court that Obamacare is derived from congressional authority to regulate interstate commerce. Which takes us to the ruling this week in Florida, where 26 states, over half the states, have joined in a very serious legal argument against this legislation. Judge Vinson, who went further than Judge Henry Hudson in the Virginia ruling, found that Congress did not have the authority to regulate inactivity under the Commerce Clause, and that that the individual mandate was therefore unconstitutional. Again, the federal power is immense, but it is not unlimited. And here is Judge Vinson, and I think this is worth listening to. It would be a radical departure from existing case law to hold that Congress can regulate inactivity under the Commerce Clause. If it has the power to compel an otherwise passive individual into a commercial transaction, and that compelling the actual transaction is itself commercial and economic in nature and substantially affects interstate commerce, it is not hyperbolizing to suggest that Congress could do almost anything it wanted. It is difficult to imagine that a nation which began, at least in part, as the result of opposition to a British mandate giving the East India Company a monopoly and imposing a nominal tax on tea sold in America would have set out to create a government with the power to force people to buy tea in the first place. If Congress can penalize a passive individual for failing to engage in commerce, the enumeration of powers in the Constitution would have been in vain, for it would be difficult to perceive any limitation on federal power. And in that, he's citing the Lopez case in the line of Commerce Clause cases. And it would have a constitution in name only. Surely this is not what the founding fathers could have intended. Other major legal arguments against Obamacare. Privacy. To the extent that the legislation interferes with an individual's right to choose health insurance providers, doctors, or lawful medical services, Obamacare may violate the right to medical self-determination recognized by the Supreme Court under the United States Constitution. And I say recognized by the court because there isn't really any language in the Constitution itself, I have to note. There is a line of cases starting with Griswold versus Connecticut in 1965 that led to abortion rulings starting with Roe v. Wade, which, quote, recognized that the special relationship between patient and physician will often be encompassed within the domain of private life protected by the Due Process Clause, close quote. That's Griswold. Several of the early abortion cases involved what Justice William O. Douglas, concurring in Doe v. Bolton in 1973, described as, quote, the right to seek advice on one's health and the right to place reliance on the physician of one's choice, close quote. Now, whether or not you agree with the abortion rulings, they do establish a strong basis for challenging certain federal and state decisions. Another major legal argument, certainly not the only one, is something called commandeering. Several recent decisions have invalidated federal laws that commandeer state governments to carry out federal law. In New York versus the United States in 1992, the court struck down federal rules requiring states to take ownership of certain radioactive waste. Justice Sandra Day O'Connor ruled that no matter how powerful the federal interest involved, the Constitution simply does not give Congress the authority to require the states to regulate. Tellingly, she added, quote, the Constitution protects us from our own best intentions. It divides power among sovereigns, precisely so that we may resist the temptation to concentrate power in one location as an expedient solution to the crisis of the day. Healthcare, whatever it may be. To the extent that the federal health care insurance legislation forces states to implement its provisions, it could be subject to constitutional challenge. I wanted to point out to you that there are certain effects if you go with a statute versus going with a constitutional amendment, just so that you can consider the two or both here in Minnesota. This statute would give Minnesota standing in current lawsuits against the federal individual mandate. It would allow Minnesota to launch additional 10th Amendment-based litigation in current lawsuits, if the current lawsuits against Obamacare fail. And it also empowers our state attorney general to litigate on behalf of individuals harmed by the mandate in 2014. You would get all of those benefits with a constitutional amendment, plus a constitutional amendment would prohibit a Canadian-style single-payer health care plan at the state level if Obamacare is upheld. And we won't know that for a year or maybe less. And it would also prohibit a state-level requirement to purchase health care insurance if Obamacare is repealed. Just to wrap things up, I thought you might be interested in finding out whether or not there was an injunction in that decision that Vincent handed down this week. Because the legislation didn't contain a severability clause, he ruled that all the legislation's out, and Hudson hadn't gone that far in the Virginia case. But legal scholars are still sorting out whether or not his decision amounted to an injunction. Twyla Braze quoted the section from the opinion that makes it sound like he may have intended an injunction, but people around the country are milling this over. I haven't been to my computer all day, so I don't think anything's happened. I think the best legal advice out there is to wait and see what the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals tells us about that ruling. But it is interesting to note that our neighbors in Wisconsin issued a stern statement this week saying that, quote, this means that for Wisconsin, the federal health care law is dead, and the state of Wisconsin is relieved of any obligations or duties to carry out the statute. I think that we have to wait and see what the 11th Circuit says, but this certainly doesn't have any impact on Senate File 33. So thank you for having me this evening.
Thank you, Ms. Crockett. Ms. Crockett, since you bring up the issue of severability, and Senator Hahn, in particular, Section 2, my question is whether or not we need a severability clause in this particular bill. Council might be able to tell us how existing statute affects this type of bill if it became law. Council?
Mr. Chairman and members, Minnesota does have kind of a generic severability provision. It's in Chapter 645, so it applies to any law automatically that's enacted in Minnesota, and it does contain a pretty strong presumption of severability. Unless a court should find that everything was so interconnected and dependent that the legislature couldn't have presumed that it not be severed. So that's in law already and applies to anything that you pass.
All right. Senator Hahn, is that the intent of at least the severability question? Do you recognize the intent of the severability issue of how Minnesota handles severability?
Well, Mr. Chairman, and Ms. Pontius, thank you for the clarification. I had understood that there was a presumption of severability, but if I understand your comment, we should assume that if any portion of this were to be found unconstitutional, specifically Section 2, Mr. Chairman, if that were the case, then that would not call into question Section 1.
All right.
And, while I believe Section 2 is constitutional, I'm not an attorney, as was pointed out earlier.
They can argue with themselves for hours.
Right? Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair and Senator Hahn, I prefer the way you say attorney to the way you say liars. just saying. Mr. Chair and Senator Hahn, Ms. Crockett, the question of severability in Judge Vinson's decision relates to the Congressional Act, not to the act before us today. And so without that severability clause, which is rather shocking with a 2,700-page bill, you'd think almost everything was in there. But it doesn't relate to our bill before us today. Judge Vinson's ruling relies on the fact that there was no severability to say that you can't carve out pieces of Obamacare and say this one is constitutional and that one is not. The whole thing got blown away by the decision. And now the question is, does it apply here in Minnesota if it's unconstitutional in 26 states? And I think I'd like to proceed with the assumption that it's unconstitutional. And I think Senator Hahn's bill is welcome at this point. And there were many of us that wanted Minnesota to join that lawsuit beginning many months ago. And so I think if we could pass Senator Hahn's bill, then we'll have direction about how to proceed. And I think that's how we should be working in this committee tonight.
Are there any further questions of the witness?
Yes.
Senator Lapp.
Thank you. Ms. Crockett, thank you for your analysis. I was a little confused about its implications. You stated that the Constitution protects persons' right to not participate in the health care system. How does that play out if someone receives an injury or becomes ill but cannot afford to seek medical care, but they show up at the emergency room door?
Ms. Crockett? Mr. Chair and Senator Latz, you set it up as a legal question, and then you said, but what happens if somebody shows up and they're hurt? I mean, I think the answer is that facility, I can't, this isn't legal analysis, but I think that facility decides whether or not to welcome someone in. They may be operating under state law or county law or whatever it might be in making that decision. So,
Ms. Brace, could you help enlighten Senator Letts?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Letts. There's a federal law called EMTALA that requires every hospital to take whomever comes into their emergency room and take care of them, at least to the point that they need. It's sort of a triage system, but that is a requirement at a federal level.
So,
Senator Letts.
Mr. Chairman, so federal law guarantees someone who attempts to opt out of the medical system, the health care system, and in the insurance system, guarantees them at taxpayer or premium payer's expense a minimal level of emergency care if they show up in an emergency room, even if they have paid not one penny toward that care because they have affirmatively opted out of the health care system?
Ms. Brace or Senator Hamm?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Letts, that's my understanding. In fact, one does not even have to be a resident of the state or the country to get that kind of attention from an emergency room. That is part of the EMTALA law, and that's the status that it is today.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Letts.
Could we require persons to forego health care because they have opted out of participation in the health care system to not participate in the insurance exchanges, for example? I mean, do we have the authority to say you cannot get any health care because you're not paying into the system?
Ms. Brace?
Well, perhaps not in exactly the way that you are saying it. I think the important thing to understand is that this bill does not say that you can't get health care. It says that you aren't required to get into a certain system, so you can pick your system. And a matter of fact, there's like $24 billion spent every year by cash paying for care. So there are different systems, and one can be your individual payment of cash. Another could be you choose your kind of health insurance, but it's not only the four plans that the federal health reform law is going to allow in the exchange. So there are different ways to participate, but in this case, the federal law requires you to participate in only one way. And you may choose not to participate in that way, and that would be the freedom that you would have as a result.
Mr. Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In my experience in the ER, we are expected to care for anybody who comes to the door in an emergency situation, but that does not relieve them of their obligation to pay for those services. So whether or not they're in any health care system, they still have an obligation to pay for the services rendered.
Mm-hmm. Senator Letts.
Mr. Chairman, maybe Senator Hoffman could enlighten us on this, too. What percentage of those persons can't afford to pay? And what percentage of those expenses are ever collected from people that don't have enough income to pay? What percentage of those health care expenses are discharged in bankruptcy because someone couldn't afford to pay? And who pays then? It sounds to me, I'll tell you who pays then, it's employers. Businesses that are paying higher premiums for their employees to cover the uninsured and the uncompensated care, which is, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars in Minnesota, and it's the taxpayers of the state of Minnesota that are providing this care. It sounds like what we're suggesting is that people should have the right to opt out of this insurance plan, but they have the right to opt into the freeload insurance plan, which is they'll take the chance that they're not going to need medical care. But when they do, and if they can't afford it, they're going to go get that care at your expense and my expense, the taxpayers' expense, and businesses' expenses in Minnesota. It sounds like they're trying to have it both ways.
Senator Letts, we're kind of going far afield from the jurisdiction of the committee on the sections 1 and 2.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Letts, you sucked them in.
Mr. Chair and Senator Letts, freedom allows people to make all kinds of decisions that we may object to.
But we don't have to pay for it,
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, and to Senator Latz's point, Judge Vinson's ruling and Senator Hand's bill doesn't address the question of access to health care. That's not the question. The question is about whether the federal government, through the Commerce Clause of our Constitution, can require an individual to buy a product, and in this case, it's health insurance, but it could equally apply to the purchase of a car. Can the federal government, through the Commerce Clause, force you or me to buy a car when we've got a perfectly good one running in the driveway, or we might like to keep it longer, we might like to ride the bus, we might not want a car at all? That's what's at stake with the lawsuit. That's what's at stake with Senator Hand's bill. It's the freedom to make those choices or to choose inactivity and not participate in the market with that particular product. And that's why I'm supporting Senator Hand's bill and appreciate the testimony tonight. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Well, Senator, on that point, Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to comment as well that this bill is not about any particular health care policy. It was provoked by what the federal government has done, but this bill does not do anything to establish any kind of specific health care policy for this state. What it really is about is the question, who should decide health care policy for the people of the state of Minnesota? That's really what this is about. What we are saying is that the decision-making authority about health care policy is in Minnesota, not in Washington, D.C. Once we establish that, to Senator Latz's point, I think we are free to decide how we're going to treat people who are insured or not insured, or what kind of treatment they will be, choices they might be able to avail themselves of. So that is not the issue of what kind of policy we're going to have. It is simply saying that we should have the right as a state to determine that policy, not the federal government.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to follow up on what Senator Hand just stated is that this bill, in my mind, really isn't at all about people exercising their right to choose health care. What it really is about is authorizing and directing the Attorney General to enforce our sovereign rights as a state. That, to me, is what this bill is about.
Thank you, Senator Newman.
Mr. Chairman, to that point?
Senator Latz.
Perhaps counsel can assist us with that. Do we have other laws where we direct the Attorney General to take enforcement action, where the Attorney General is divested of their jurisdiction and are required to take enforcement action or injunctive relief of some sort?
Ms. Pontius?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Latz, I'm not aware of anything that actually mandates the Attorney General to enforce something. They're given enforcement powers in the consumer protection area. Like if you look at the second section of the bill, which amends 8.31, you know, the language on like 2.24 and 2.25 says the Attorney General shall investigate violations of the laws, but then it's up to the Attorney General as to what kind of enforcement actions to take based on those investigations. The Attorney General can sue and do various things under the statute.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Latz.
Ms. Pontius, is there any case law interpreting the power of the legislature to mandate the constitutionally separate Attorney General?
Ms. Pontius.
In that regard?
I'm sorry.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Latz, I couldn't find a case directly on point in Minnesota, but I know there are separation of powers arguments that could be made, saying that the legislature cannot order the Attorney General as a constitutional officer in the executive branch, so there's the official, head of the state's legal department. And, I found some general statements in some cases saying that it's the Attorney General has discretion as to what litigation is or isn't appropriate. And, as I recall, the government of Plenty had asked Attorney General Swanson to intervene in the Florida case, and she declined, in fact, indicating that her intention was to file an amicus brief in support of the government because she believed the law was constitutional. So it's possible that, you know, she could or could not decide to actually take the shell in the bill as a shell. It certainly authorizes the Attorney General to do it.
Ms. Pontius, in the opposite logic, is there anything in case law or any other area of law that would deny the legislature to direct the Attorney General into any injunctive relief?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not aware of anything that's addressed it one way or the other.
All right.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. At this point, if the legislature passes this bill, it is still not complete instruction to the Attorney General because it would have to go to the governor first. And so if the governor were to sign this bill, the governor would also have the authority, if the Attorney General once again refused to litigate this case, could seek additional counsel or other counsel, and the Attorney General actually could assist in identifying other counsel to represent the state of Minnesota. But that is the function of the Attorney General's office, to provide counsel if she herself is unwilling to do that. And so I think it's pretty premature at this point to argue whether or not the Attorney General would or could institute litigation if she chose not to. I think it's premature, and I think we should proceed on this bill and go further. We can explore it with the research going forward, but there's still much to come, including executive branch review of the legislation.
Members, before we get further into the discussion of the bill, we have another witness that's
Mr. Chairman,
willing to come
before
to the
we
table.
Do that,
sure,
could
Senator
I,
Hand.
On this point, and I hesitate to engage in this legal argument for fear of being accused of practicing law without a license, but I'll take that risk for a moment. Just to suggest that if the bill were to pass, and if indeed Section 2 were decided to be inoperable or something, it would seem to me that if the law of the state of Minnesota, at least in Section 1, if that is the law of the state, it would seem to me that the Attorney General would have an obligation, regardless of the existence of Section 2, to defend the law and the people's rights in the state of Minnesota as outlined in Section 1. So in some ways, I think Section 2 is perhaps redundant or superfluous. If Section 1 is adopted as law, it would obligate the Attorney General to act on our behalf to defend those rights. So that's my non-legal legal argument here, and I'll rest my case with that.
Chair would like to call Greg O'Connor to the witness table. Thank you, witnesses. Mr. O'Connor, welcome to the committee. Would you identify yourself and your organization?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. My name is Greg O'Connor, and for the record, I have been a small business owner operator for the last 42 years, and more recently the Director of Legislative Affairs for the Republican Liberty Caucus. I'm here today to speak in favor of Senate File 33, the Freedom of Choice in Healthcare Act. The question seems to revolve around our state's sovereign rights as they relate to actions taken by the federal government. As I read Senate File 33, and particularly Subdivision 3, quote, the statement of public policy, end quote, it seems to be well written, short, to the point, and easy for the average citizen to understand. The Constitution of the United States as well is very easy to understand and brief in comparison to the 2,700 pages of the federal health care bill. As was mentioned earlier, just last Monday declared for the second time by a federal judge to be unconstitutional. Also mentioned, 26 other states are now on record suing to block or render null and void this federal health care law. Why then, I have to wonder, would there be any Minnesota elected official who would vote against Senate File 33, a bill that simply says that Minnesota will exercise its sovereign constitutional powers guaranteed as outlined in the main body of the U.S. Constitution and restated for emphasis in the 9th and 10th Amendments. I think it's important to reflect that the preamble in the Constitution says, we the people, that's you and me, that's all of us in this room,
we the people ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. To me, that means that we the people created this new layer of government, and it's subjugated to us, except in very limited, enumerated ways that we accept in a constitutional republic. In closing, I strongly urge a unanimous vote in favor of the passage of Senate File 33, and I commend Senator Hahn for his efforts in this cause. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. O'Connor. Is there any questions for the witness? Thank you, Mr. O'Connor. Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hahn, I saw this bill the other day in the other committee, obviously, but in your committee. And I understand that you don't like the federal health care reform, and you feel it's not, I assume if it was Romney Care in Massachusetts, you wouldn't object to that. You object to the fact that the federal government is violating it. I understand that. And I understand that a lot of states are going to court on this, and two judges, apparently two on each side so far, have ruled in favor and against the federal law. And I understand that you'd like our attorney general to do that. I just think this is strange. I mean, I've often talked about people having a right to health care and choice of health care. This mode of securing is an interesting language. I don't usually think of that. I know that that's obviously a great concern to you because you propose this statement of public policy, but it seems, I mean, when I read that, it seems more like a legal analysis than a statement of policy, though you do have a statement in there. My question is, I guess it seems strange that we want to enforce a statement of policy. I mean, why don't you try something like either spell out, point out where in our Constitution or whatever, or spell out that right either as a constitutional amendment or something, or and then state that. I mean, it seems to be you want to enforce a public policy statement. Do we ever enforce statements before? It seems a strange way of doing it, and I'm just curious about that.
Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Senator Marty. That is a good question, and I'll tell you, I agree with you that this is an unusual bill, and in the relatively short time that I've been in the legislature, I don't think I've seen a bill quite like this. In fact, I've seen other bills where we've had statements of policy and other things that we've routinely said, let's do away with that. And I have tended in the past to be in agreement with that approach. However, I think what we have is a unique situation, and that is really the reason why the bill exists in the first place. We have a situation where many of us, me in particular, believe that the federal government has done something that is not constitutionally warranted. And so the question is, if you believe the federal government has acted beyond its scope of powers, what do you do? What do you do about that as a state? What is the power that the state has, and how should that power be exercised to contest a exercise of power that the state may believe to be unwarranted? Now, I'm not a believer in nullification theory of, some people might believe that that's the way we do it. We just nullify federal law. I don't believe that. And I do believe that the separation of powers and the balance of powers between states and the federal government was altered, I think wrongly altered, by the direct election of the U.S. senators rather than having the senators represent the states as states in the U.S. Senate. Instead, they now represent the people of the state at large. I think that has harmed that ability for states as states to have a meaningful check on the power of the federal government. So that is really the question that we're trying to figure out, trying to resolve. What is the constitutional way to reestablish the balance of power between states and the federal government when there is a legitimate dispute? And I think it is legitimate. If something is questioned as to the constitutionality, how do you contest that, short of picking up arms and going to war, which also I believe is unconstitutional? And so what we're trying to do here is establish as a policy or a statement of law in Minnesota that this is what we believe to be true about the status of states versus the federal government with respect to a particular policy, namely health care policy. And in doing so, as was mentioned earlier in the testimony, I think that would provide us other avenues to contest if we chose and if this bill were to pass, the encroachment of federal power in this area of policy. And I don't know of any other way to do that as a state unless we have a governor who may wish to do that, as some have in joining the lawsuit. I know Governor Plenty had asked for that, I believe, last year, and our Attorney General chose not to do that. But I think as a legislature, and as a legislature who was elected by the people of the state, I think that we technically do not now have standing in any kind of dispute. I would think that by taking this as law, making it as law, we would have standing to assert the rights of the people as embodied in the legislature to speak on behalf of this issue for the state of Minnesota. So I agree with you, this is unique. I'm not advocating that every bill have a statement of policy and to do this. I take the general point. But I think because of the unique conditions that gave rise to this bill, I think it makes sense for us to make that statement and to create the grounding for us to contest that power of the federal government.
Thank you, Senator Hahn. Members, before we continue, I also wanted to put into the record a written testimony of a Mr. Walter Hudson. He represents an organization called MNCD3 Tea Party Patriots, and he's speaking on behalf of or in support of Senator Hahn's bill. Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to comment on Senator Marty's issue of a public policy type of statement, and we have routinely taken them out of bills since I've been here, and yet they do exist in a number of bills in environment and energy where we've set a public policy preamble, if you will, to some of the processes that we've gone through. But I think it's important, members, that we do it in this particular case because of the constitutional ramifications. And I think we've seen bigger ramifications over the years in terms of the federal government takeover of everything from education to many other issues, I guess, since the 1960s. And nobody has fought back until this point. And it has become a crisis of major proportion in terms of our ability to do policy. And so I think this is something that we definitely need to start today. I would argue we should have started 30 years ago, 40 years ago, but this is one case that I think it sets out a great statement of need and why we need to, as states, take back our rights.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, Sir Jungbauer, I'm not opposing the fact that you want to put a statement into law. We've done that many times. I don't have objection to that. It just seems strange that we putting in a statement of policy. This one seems a little bit strange, the mode of securing health care services, where we define this new mode of securing and then say that we've got a policy that's our right, and that the federal government's violating it. My only point is that usually we don't try and enforce a statement of public policy that way. And that was what struck me as strange. Not that he has his right as a member of the Senate to offer this, and it may well pass. I'm just saying that it seems to be a very unusual process to try and enforce a statement of public policy that we just created instead of creating a law, creating a statement that we're going to enforce.
Senator Hahn, going back to Section 2, you direct the Attorney General to seek injunctive relief. And you might remember from your judiciary days that whenever we give authority to any Attorney General in this manner, is it, the way I'm reading it, is this giving only the Attorney General? Does the Attorney General, is that person the only person of standing that can seek injunctive relief?
Mr. Chairman, and committee members, I believe, I recall, I couldn't quote it for certain, maybe counsel could help, but I think the general statute section that this is amending does speak to rights of individuals to seek relief as well. I don't know that this would invalidate that.
Well, Senator Thompson?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I would like to propose an amendment that would hopefully clarify that, seeing as how the There is a question as to whether the Attorney General would take action in such a matter, and there seems to be some question as to whether there would be an individual right to do so, this amendment. And I believe Ms. Pontius may be able to do a better job of describing the technical aspects of it than I would, because I did not do the research or the drafting on it. The amendment would create or clarify a private remedy that would, A, allow an individual to bring a case to enforce his or her rights under this statute, and then also it specifically proclaims that any such action is deemed to be in the public interest in an effort to accord that litigant standing to bring such a case. I would move that amendment at this point, and I understand it's being handed out as we speak.
Senator Thompson, is that the A2 amendment?
Yes, it is.
Members, do you have the amendment yet? No. We'll wait while it's passed out. Senator Hand, do you have a copy of the amendment?
Mr. Chairman, I do have a copy. I've not seen the amendment before. This was the section in the statute that I was trying to recall that speaks to private remedies. And as I said, I don't believe that the bill I'm proposing would alter the private remedy opportunity.
Sorry, Ann, I'm familiar with this type of wording. I've often brought it forward at the time when we seem to, in law, isolate standing only to the Attorney General. And that may bar anyone else from bringing an action in the event that the Attorney General doesn't agree or doesn't want to go forward. At least we give the rights, the right of private remedy to the individual citizen as well. And quite honestly, I think that's a good thing. And I don't believe that we should isolate the power of any remedy only to a government official. So in order to avoid any other confusion on this, this particular amendment is a good idea, and I don't believe it does any harm to your bill.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I haven't seen the amendment before. I agree with you. I don't think it does any harm. I'm not sure that it is absolutely necessary, but I'm willing to defer to the judgment of the committee.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, and to the amendment, I agree that it probably doesn't do any harm to the bill. But it can't confer jurisdiction or standing in federal court. It could allow an action in state court, but no federal court action could be derived from this.
All right. Good point. Any other questions? Senator Thompson renews his motion. And that Amendment A2 be recommended to pass. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? No. Amendment passes. Any further discussion on Senate File 33? Mr. Latz?
Just a note on the question of public policy. I think we're setting something of a dangerous precedent in the committee here on two points. One is I think there really is substantial doubt about the constitutionality some of the portions of this bill, Section 2 included. We heard Ms. Pontius state that there's a separation of powers argument made. While there may not be a specific case that says this is constitutional, I think there's substantial doubt about it, and I think it's a judiciary that may have an obligation to involve committees in the legislature to take a very serious legal analysis. Because the rest of the legislature is going to give a lot of deference to this committee's judgment on that question. And I'm not satisfied that we have fully analyzed the constitutionality of mandating a constitutionally separate chief law enforcement officer in the state of Minnesota to take certain action. My second point, and it's not just Section 2, but there's Section 1, Subdivision 4B, also mandates the Attorney General's office to take any action defense of prosecution the right to protect the session. The second one was to Senator Marty's point having to do with public policy. No, yes, there are rare occasions when we have public policy statements and laws. They exist primarily because there may come a time when the court will have to apply the standard of the canon of interpretation of state statutes. If a statute is deemed to be ambiguous or some provisions are conflicting, then the judiciary has an obligation to take into consideration the purpose or intent of the legislature when interpreting the statutes to resolve that ambiguity. And you stated the purpose at the beginning. Otherwise, a larger bill that has specific laws to be applied, citizens must comply with, would give the courts that kind of guidance. There is no such application in the bill that we have before us today, and I think that's a dangerous precedent for this committee and this legislature potentially to set, broadening the application of public policy statements. The third point that happened, I think maybe it's just a question. If in fact this bill is successful in mandating that the Attorney General take some action, typically they will make judgments about what litigation can or not be in for a variety of reasons, including the availability of the resources to do so. And this mandates that they take potentially some extraordinarily expensive litigation through a whole variety of legal channels, the federal court, going up to the United States Supreme Court. It's a broadly written mandate that's here. And I wonder if there's a fiscal note attached to this legislation that would determine how much it costs the Attorney General's office to implement the mandates that this bill purports to impose upon.
Senator Hamm?
There is no fiscal note. I think there ought to.
Mr. Chairman, and Senator, last to your question, there is a fiscal note that was prepared, and I did not I didn't mention that to Senator Limmer in talking about the bill. They did a fiscal note on the section that pertained to the elimination of the medical assistance. There is a cost to that. The fiscal note portion that speaks to the Attorney General's office did not have a cost attached to that portion of the note. It was a zero fiscal note, which is why I did not think to submit it. I probably should have. I apologize to the committee. It's a good question, but in the judgment of the fiscal analyst.
Could you speak up just a little bit, Senator?
Pardon me?
Just speak up a little bit.
I was just saying I apologize to the committee. I didn't think that to include it in the materials I submitted to Senator Limmer, but the fiscal analyst did look at the potential cost implications to the Attorney General's office. They concluded there was no cost. The fiscal note was a zero note. I can certainly make that available to the committee members. I'm not asking you to take my word for it, but I apologize. I should have submitted that. But there was a fiscal note done.
Mr. Turner, do you have any comment regarding fiscal note?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members. There was a fiscal note done. As Senator Hand said, it was determined no cost to the Attorney General. But, of course, the Attorney General is not in our jurisdiction anyway. And MMB determined that there was no cost to the courts.
Mm-hmm. We'll be sending this bill to Senate Finance anyway. Senator Ortman, did you have a comment?
Yes. Mr. Chair, to Senator Latz's points, and they're well taken, I do think it is important at this point that we adopt a statement of public policy because it's an unusual thing for the state of Minnesota and the legislature to assert 10th Amendment constitutional rights against the federal government. I haven't been here that long, but some people would claim I'm an old guy around here. I've never seen it before. It's not an easy thing to do, but we all have a constitutional oath to uphold. And for me, it's important for us to state why we're passing this bill so that it be given the due consideration of the residents of the state, of our federal delegation, of our state attorney general, of our governor. I think it requires a higher level of scrutiny on the part of our colleagues at the federal and other office holders and our residents to see the whole purpose of this bill. And so I would hope we would keep it intact. And, Mr. Chair, I would move the bill.
Senator Ortman moves Senate File 33. Be recommended to pass. and be moved to the Senate Finance Committee.
Mr. Chair, as amended.
As amended, I'm sorry. Senator Marty?
Mr. Chair, as I told you, I think the bill is unusual. I understand people's strong feelings one way or another about the federal law. I think in your statement of public policy, your B paragraph, deleting the words mode of securing, which I'm not proposing to do, but I mean that would state my belief as to what our constitutional rights are, that we have a right to choose or decline any health care services. I think this mode of securing is an unusual thing, and I understand why you have it in there. I'm just saying that my interest would be in making sure people have a right to health care, not to a mode of securing health care services. But
and Mr. Chairman and Senator Marty, and I know you and I have discussed this. I do not believe there is a right to health care. The rights that we have under the Constitution are not positive rights, as I understand them. They are, in effect, negative rights. They do not require, as a for me to exercise my rights under the Constitution, does not require that I diminish anyone else's rights or take anything from anyone else. A right to health care, if that is so construed, would require that, which is why I do not believe it is a constitutional right. However, I do certainly believe it is in the general police powers of a state to enact such provisions, which is why I think what Massachusetts did is certainly constitutional under their law. But it is not constitutional under federal law for the federal government to do a similar thing. And again, my point with the bill is not to say this should or should not be our particular policy. I know my opinion on the federal policy and yours may differ. But I would hope that you would agree with me that it is important, I believe more important, that we retain the right in Minnesota to decide those questions rather than cede the general point that it is the federal government's power and duty to make those decisions for the people of Minnesota. So I would certainly respectfully ask that you consider supporting the bill.
Is there further discussion? Hearing none, Senator Ortman renews her recommendation that Senate File 33 be recommended to pass as amended and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Bill passes. A motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Seeing no other further business before the committee, the Senate Judiciary Committee is adjourned.